Hello, I'm Brian DeShazer, director of the Pacifica Radio Archives, the oldest and largest collection of public radio programming in the United States. And welcome to From the Vault, our weekly series that takes that history out of our vault and onto the radio. This week on From the Vault, we continue our exploration of treaties signed and treaties broken between the United States and the indigenous tribes of this land. This week, we present Tim McGovern's eye-opening probe into the theft of over 9 million acres from the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy, traditional land of the Confederacy that was confirmed as their land by no less than six treaties, including the 1792 agreement signed by U.S. Presidents George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. Tim McGovern's striking documentary entitled Ganyenke uses the art of oral tradition of tribal elders to tell the story of the Six Nations' formation, prosperity, treaties with the United States and Canadian governments, the betrayal of those governments, and the eventual struggle to reclaim their traditional homelands beginning in May 1974. Here is Tim McGovern and his 1976 documentary on the Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy, Ganyenke.
In everything we do as a nation, we always think, how will this affect seven generations from now? And we must decide unanimously on what course to take. It has always been our way, under the great law of peace. That is why our grandfathers made treaties with the United States to provide for the future generations of our people. That is why, too, when the missionaries were killing off our people, burning them at the stake, our grandfathers decided that it would be better to join the religion of the missionaries than to have everyone killed. They said that if the nation could just survive them, that their grandchildren would be able to restore the true way. We are the grandchildren.
Those are the words of Tegalanyanegu, a Mohawk chief of the Six Nation Iroquois Confederacy. The grandchildren are now in the process of restoring the true way. In May of 1974, they reclaim Ganyenge, the land of the Flint. It's the ancestral territory of the Mohawk Nation. Ganyenge is located in New York's Adirondack Forest Preserve, which is made up of about 6 million acres. And about 3 million of those acres can be described as wilderness. The people at Ganyenge make it clear that the only land they want returned to them is land that's rightfully theirs and is now held by the government. They do not want to take land that's now owned by private individuals. Ganyenge is a traditional Mohawk community, and hopefully it will soon be a totally self-sustaining community whose doors are open to all Indian people.
There are Indian people today, there always have been, and we feel there always will be. People who will want to live close to the land, who will want to live closely to their traditional Indian way of life, who will want to retain their own language, who will want to retain their own self-governing processes, and you know, who will want to relate on this earth as Indian people. And Ganyenge, for the first time, will give Indian people, Indian children, that opportunity.
That's Gugwilegelu, one of the official spokespeople at Ganyenge. He pointed out that one of the settlement's long-range goals is to produce enough food to help feed those who are starving today on Indian reservations throughout North America. An example of the positive results that the men, women, and children who reclaim Ganyenge hope to achieve. They do not want a confrontation with the government or anyone else. All they want is a basic freedom, the freedom of choice. They feel that as a nation, they should be able to decide for themselves what kind of life they will live, what kind of religion they will practice, what type of government they will obey. The choice at Ganyenge is the great law of peace. For the first part of this two-hour program, we'll hear about the origins of the great law and some of its basic principles. After that, we'll begin exploring Ganyenge itself. Garanyaktaje is the secretary of the Ganyenge Council Fire. He handles most of the settlement's correspondence, which comes from all over the world. He told me about the Law of the Great Peace and the Six Nation Confederacy.
The Six Nations Iroquois Confederacy, founded approximately 1,000 years ago. And this estimation was the latest by scientific estimates. They found an artifact about 15 years ago, which when put to scientific tests, the artifact, definitely Iroquoian, was found to date back to around 900 A.D. So it's about 1,000 years old. And at that time, the people who formed the Six Nations Confederacy were always at war with each other, say like the Onondagas and the Mohawks and the Oneidas, Cayugas, Senecas. They were always fighting each other. And not only these nations, but also the Hurons and all the other Indian nations were at war continually. Then one young man by the name of Deganawida, who was a Huron, very young, and he thought there must be a way to stop this waste of human. And he thought hard and long on it, and being a very, super intelligent young fellow, he suddenly saw a way to stop it. And he thought that by law, people would stop killing each other and have peace. So he devised this law. He took from natural righteousness and made a code, which he called Ganregoa, or Law of the Great Peace. And armed with this Law of the Great Peace, he approached his own nation, the Hurons, with this idea of universal peace. While his own people didn't think much of the idea. They were a big, strong nation and afraid of no one. They were all warriors and successful, usually, in battles. Besides that, the young fellow had an impediment of the speech. He had a bad lisp, and he stuttered. And he had a double row of teeth, which you sometimes see among people, and that contributed to his impediment. He had trouble expressing his ideas. So he was turned down by his own nation. And so he crossed the lake. This is Lake Ontario. By the way, that name is a Mohawk word. And the right pronunciation is Kanyadariyo, which means beautiful lake, Kanyadariyo. They corrupted it to Ontario. He crossed that lake and he landed in the country of the Mohawks. And the first person that he spoke to was a Mohawk woman. And she had a cabin along the trail. And she gave him food, and he rested there, and he told her about his plan of a universal peace. And his plan seemed very, very good to the woman. And she was the first to accept it. His own people didn't think much of it, but this woman saw the possibilities, and that encouraged him no end. And she spoke so intelligently on the subject that he thought that women should have a place in this new plan of things. And they believe that's how the clan mother system originated, when a woman was the first to accept the great law.
The Indian women was liberated at the time of the making of the Confederacy in the government itself.
This is Ozit Nwanyo, the Turtle Clan mother at Ganyange.
In the Bear Clan, there would be three chiefs, and there's also three chiefs in the Wolf Clan and three in the Turtle in a community like here. And then each chief is appointed by the woman and sees to it that he performs his duties according to the laws. And then if he doesn't, he's deposed by her if she feels that he's not doing the, he's performing his duties according to the laws. The Confederacy is eternal rather than, I guess, what they call paternalistic. Say, for instance, families, women of the Wolf family, the children they bear would be automatically under that clan.
Well, he came on, and finally he met the Mohawks, and he met a transplanted Onondaga chief. Well, he became a chief in the Mohawk Nation. He was adopted, and he worked his way to being a chief, and his name was Ayunwata. And this was corrupted by Longfellow to Hiawatha. And he had trouble in his own nation, which is why he left them, and he became a Mohawk. And he worked his way to being a chief. And he was so happy about this new great law, this idea of a universal peace, and about this message that the young fellow had to offer. And the Mohawks accepted the great law right away. While they were the least in number, and they were continuously being harassed by bigger and stronger nations, so they were glad to have an end to all this hostility so they can stop continually fighting. So Ayunwata volunteered to help the Ganawida to spread this gospel among the, all the nations. And he went with them to do his speaking because of the Ganawida's impediment of the speech. So they went to the other nations, and it took a total of 5 years before they could convince all of them. And the last to be convinced, to be converted, were the was the Onondaga war chief. The Onondagas also wanted peace among their neighbors. They were also tired of this constant warfare. But they had a war chief who had sort of a despotic control. And he hated peace, and he had great power, and he almost supernatural power. And he was a dictator. He was a very evil man, but he was finally converted. So the five nations finally were organized into one unit. And this is one of the things that explains why it was called a longhouse. It's symbolically a house stretching from the easternmost limits of the Mohawk territory to the most western boundary of the Senecas. And symbolically, the longhouse stretches from one end to the other, see? So that's why it was called the longhouse. And the founder had put all the five nations into this one longhouse. And all their law and their spiritual performances, their rituals and ceremonies were all included. He did not take away any of their spiritual ceremonies. He said they could keep them individually as nations, but all they had to do was follow the great law, and there would be peace forevermore. And there was peace for a long, long time. They became so strong that when they're attacked by other nations, they always were able to prevail. And in time, nations came to them for protection. And up to the time of the European advent into America, this protectorate of Indian nations numbered up to 28. That was the surrounding nations. And they all had peace for some good 200 years before the white man came. And that was busted up by the French. And well, the English had something to do with it too. But when the wars began, when the Six Nations, by 1712, a sixth nation was added. That was the Tuscaroras. There were only five up to then. But when they, the French, and they, at that time in Jesuit relations, they take all the credit for having started the wars, which involved the Five Nations Confederacy with all the 28 protectorate nations, plus the Hurons, plus the Algonquins, and the French. So the Confederacy had 31 nations opposing them in a war, an all-out war, which the French had instigated. The reason they give for this is that they didn't think the continent could be opened up unless this Confederacy was abolished. And they could not do it themselves because they were very powerful and they needed nations to help. And so they sent out these Jesuits to the surrounding nations and incited the young men to take up arms and attack their own protectors, because these were protectorate nations. They couldn't do it for a while. For about 25 years, they couldn't get any action. Finally, they were able to convince the young men that they were being treated like women. They were told that no, a voice in the councils of the, you know, in the Grand Council of the Six Nations. And they were being, well, treated like women, you know, and so on. Finally, they got together and they attacked the protectors, the Six Nations. This was in the 1640s. In 1649, the Five Nations at that time, Confederacy, the Iroquois, attacked Urania. This was the Huron territory. And from what the accounts say, when that war was finished, there was only 300 Hurons left. And these had fled to Quebec City, leaving their own country, the Urania. That's Ontario. Including two Jesuits. The Dutch had formed an alliance with the Five Nations, and they had warned the Iroquois that there was traitors in their midst and spies. Now, the Six Nations had no idea about spies, and they were new at this game. But that's all an old game in Europe. They told them that these priests were making maps and drawing plans of all the different castles. That's what they called the towns where they had the council houses, and they was pretty well fortified. And when they came upon this Reverends Brebeuf and Lalemant over in the Huron country, they found maps and they found descriptions of the Indian strengths and weaknesses in the various castles. They had been present in all the Iroquois towns, these priests. And they had all kinds of drawings and all marked where the French could come in to attack, or where the allies would be shown how to attack and destroy these Indian villages. Well, they tried them. This is a war chief's tribunal. And they tried them on charges of espionage. There are two offenses that drew the death penalty in the Six Nations law, and that's the espionage and treason, you know, by traitors. So this was spies, and that lived among the Iroquois for over 30 years, you know, here and there. And you'd wonder why that was possible. According to the Jesuit Relations and other history books, these priests were very, very brave. They went among such terrible people. But the fact of the matter is, these terrible people had a code that when any stranger came amongst their midst, they had to give him shelter, they had to give him food to eat. If he was in rags, they'd give him new clothes. That's their code. So these priests were able to move very freely among the Six Nations. And at no time were they ever in danger. In fact, they were safer there than in their native France. And Brebeuf had vowed before he left France that he would be martyred so he could go down to posterity as a saint. But he was getting impatient. He was here now, 33 years he's been here. And still, he had committed all kinds of spying activities. And here he was still living. He hasn't been martyred yet. And this is what he wanted. He wanted to become a saint. He was now about 50, in his 50s. And he thought he'd get caught, you know, early and he'd die a martyr, a hero. But now he got his opportunity. The Indians caught him red-handed. And they had known what to look for. The Dutch had shown them, see, plans. They told him something like this. You get drawings like this, and done by the priest. And they found it. They found it in their possession, the two of them. So they were caught and tried before this tribunal of war chiefs, which had the power to try such cases in the field. They didn't have to take them back to the Grand Council, where they could be tried before the peace chiefs. But they could do this, since this is a war. They would try them themselves. And they were convicted and sentenced to death. But they had the choice of the mode of execution. The Iroquois method of executing a criminal was a blow on the head with a war club. Well, that ended the man's career. But the Jesuits chose the European method of burning at the stake. This was also the church's favorite. And this was being done every day in France and Spain and Germany. And people were dying at the stake every day. And that was the way a man who died for his faith. He didn't have to stop in purgatory, see. And he'd go straight to heaven. And also, he'd go down in the books of the Holy Church as a saint. And that's what happened. These two men became saints in the calendar, Saint John de Brebeuf and Saint Gabriel Lallemand. They committed these acts on purpose to become saints. So the people who read about this shouldn't feel too concerned, because this is what the priests wanted. They wanted to be known as saints. But the villain, of course, was the Indian, because he burnt them at the stake. But that's what they chose, because in their belief, if you die by fire, you are cleansed by fire. See, that's if you were killed by blowing the head, you weren't cleansed by fire. This was a church belief that in order to avoid purgatory, a place which no one can prove exists, you had to be burnt at the stake in order to go straight to heaven. See, this is what why they chose such a horrible way of dying. They wanted to be sure they went to heaven. It's just, I don't know, to me it's a crazy idea.